Auntie Jane by Geoffrey Parkinson, with William Edel as Hugh, Luke Robertson as young Hugh, Andrew Sachs as father, June Barry as mother, and Elizabeth Mansfield as Auntie Jane.
I was born at 173 Kemble Road, Epsom, on the 26th of September, 1927, at 6:30 in the morning. I was christened Hugh William Ilsley. My mother was Claire Elizabeth Ilsley. She was tall and thin, suffered from nervous asthma, drank endless cups of tepid tea, and spent a lot of time hoping she believed in God.
It's not one of my good days today, Hugh.
My father was Raymond Ilsley. He loved his garden, his car, his job, his wife and his two children, in that order. He seemed to me to be a distant man, a gentleman, a wry-humoured man, a man capable of neither great love nor great hatred. But above everything else, he was an orderly, circumspect man.
There is a fitness to things, Hugh. You'll find there is a fitness to things.
And then finally there was my brother, Ian. Ian was 3 years older than me, and he took on the responsibility for guiding me along life's path, pulling my hair whenever I was tempted to stray, and sometimes when I wasn't.
Just do what I say and you'll be all right, Hugh.
Okay, but let go of me.
Please?
Please.
The life of our home, like the life of most suburban homes, commenced each week on a Monday morning. My father rose at precisely 10 to 7, made my mother a cup of tea, then went into the bathroom to wash and shave.
I wish I could shave, Daddy.
You will one day.
I'd like to shave now. Can I, Daddy?
Can you what?
Can I try shaving?
No, Hugh, no. Run along. Go and say good morning to your mother.
Oh. Mummy, I've come to say good morning, Mummy. And can I get in bed with you?
No, darling. What time is it?
The big hand is just past the top, and the little hand is just past the bottom. Quite a lot.
Oh. Where's your father, Hugh?
He's in the bathroom shaving.
Oh, would you go and ask him if he would make yours and Ian's breakfast this morning? I'm afraid I'm feeling a bit wheezy.
After breakfast every Monday morning, my father would set off for the West Country in the service of his employers, Wentworthy's Piston Rings.
Try to be a good boy, Hugh, and try to help your mother.
Yes, Daddy. Goodbye, Daddy.
I would stand and watch his car go up Kemble Road until it vanished out of sight. Then I would go back into the house feeling a sense of emptiness and loss. During the week, my father would send my mother 2 postcards. The first would arrive by the second post on Tuesday.
Dear Claire, arrived Exeter 4 p.m. Weather started with rain but now brighter. I'm staying at the Crown Hotel. Tomorrow off to Ilfracombe. We'll write again Wednesday. Hope children behaving themselves. Yours, Ray.
By the second post Thursday, the second card would arrive.
Dear Claire, arrived Ilfracombe 11:45 a.m. Weather started fine, not so good now. I'm staying at the George Arms. Hope to arrive home 4 p.m. Friday. Trust you're well and children behaving themselves. Yours, Ray.
My mother never threw these cards away. They were carefully collected in a large elastic band and placed in my father's writing compactum. Once home on Friday night, the ritual was firm, unvarying.
Daddy, have you a present for us, Daddy?
Shut up making such a noise, Hugh.
Now, boys, let your father get out of the car.
Let Daddy get out of the car, Hugh.
Hello, Claire. How are you?
Oh, not too bad, really, most of the week. But my chest started to play me out this morning.
I'm sorry to hear that. How have the children been?
Well, not too bad, really.
I've been good anyway, Daddy.
After tea, my father would change into his old clothes and go into the garden. Curiously, he would never actually admit to his deep love of gardening.
Why are you always in the garden, gardening, Daddy?
Your mother likes a nice garden, Hugh.
Oh.
Perhaps she did, yet she rarely seemed to go into it. Sometimes I'd notice her standing at the living room window, staring out at my father, a wan look on her face. Occasionally, my father, seeing her, would pause and wave, and she would give a half wave back and then, after a moment, turn away. In the hall of our house we had a calendar. It was 2 years out of date, but it remained there because it informed visitors of my father's fundamental philosophy. Beneath a pastel-coloured picture of a country cottage there was a poem, all of which I've long since forgotten, except the last two lines. You are nearer to God's heart in a garden than anywhere else on earth. For years and years, I somehow imagined this must be one of the sayings of Jesus.
How can we enter the kingdom, Father?
I say unto you, a man is nearer unto my Father's heart in a garden than anywhere else on earth.
This man surely speaketh the truth!
His name be praised!
Of our two sets of neighbours in Kemble Road, the Herberts and the Walters, my father preferred the Walters. At first this struck me as rather odd, because Mr. Herbert was clearly a devoted gardener.
Mr. Ilsley? excuse me, Mr. Ilsley?
Good afternoon, Mr. Herbert.
I hope I'm not interrupting you. Only this morning Mrs. Herbert looked out the bedroom window and said to me, I'm sure there's some henbane growing next to Mr. Ilsley's chrysanthemums. And I replied to Mrs. Herbert, surely you must be wrong, Yvonne. But then I, being a nosy Parker, I took a quick little look over the fence, and sure enough, Mrs. Herbert was right. It was henbane.
Oh.
You know, of course, henbane is poisonous.
Is it?
Extremely poisonous.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. You know all the plants that are poisonous, do you, Mr. Ilsley?
Of course there's poison ivy.
Yes, everyone knows poison ivy, of course. Well, even young Hugh probably knows about poison ivy, don't you, Hugh?
Yes.
Yeah, of course you do. But then there's thorn apple. Now, that's poisonous.
Ah.
There's Christmas rose. That's poisonous. Poisonous lettuce, as you may guess from its name, is poisonous. Cuckoo pint is poisonous, bittersweet is poisonous, and so, of course, is hemlock. But in my humble opinion, henbane is probably more poisonous than the whole lot put together. Henbane, that is.
Oh, well, I'll dig it up. Thank you, Mr. Herbert.
Mr. Ilsley, you've got some henbane next to your chrysanthemum.
Yeah, I've just told Mr. Ilsley, Yvonne.
Well, that's all right, then.
You know, Mr. Ilsley, there's nothing that Mrs. Herbert doesn't notice in the garden.
No.
Particularly if it's poisonous.
The Walters, our other neighbours, on the other hand, had clearly made no attempt to create a proper garden. Back and front were both put down to crazy paving, which they then populated with a vast army of highly coloured gnomes. Furthermore, Mr. Walters had an extremely odd way of speaking, which I later was told had something to do with his failing an English degree at one of the lesser-known universities.
Good afternoon, Mr. Walters.
How is the world with you today, Mr. Ilsley?
Not too bad. Phew. And with you?
Passing fair, passing fair. I could not help espying that your azaleas are doing most wonderfully well this happy summer day.
Oh, very kind of you to say so, Mr. Walters. Actually, they're not azaleas, they're delphiniums.
Are they so? Are they so?
Yes.
Well, well. I suppose a delphinium does as a delphinium does, just as an azalea does as an azalea does, and that's the truth of it, eh?
I suppose so, yes.
This day, I have been dispatched by my beloved Doris to cleanse the gnomes. Winter, with its wet and wearisome winds, makes them prodigally dirty, Mr. Ilsley. Prodigally dirty.
I'm sure.
Mm.
Daddy, will you lift me up so I can see the gnomes?
Not at the moment, Hugh.
Who is that scurrying and hurrying around your legs? Is it young Hugh or young Ian?
It's young Hugh. I want to see the gnomes, Daddy.
Please be quiet, Hugh.
Pass the lad to me. I'll let him see the gnomes.
Oh, that's very kind of you, Mr. Walters. I'm sure gnomes are a great deal less nuisance than children.
Doris and I, we would give you all our gnomes for just one of your children, Mr. Ilsley, and a few gnomes more.
In a world that seemed rather arid, I suppose the one delight came at 5 o'clock each day with children's hour on the wireless.
Hello, children. Hello, all of you. Wherever you may be.
Often I would imagine Uncle Mac arriving at my home and taking me away to an endlessly happy world called Children's Hour, where I'd be able to play with Larry the Lamb and Dennis the Dachshund. In a way, I suppose I gradually abandoned hope of finding much happiness in life and struggled as best I could to avoid unhappiness. The one great unhappiness I could rarely avoid came on Sunday mornings.
My text for the day comes from Genesis chapter 17, verse 15. And God said unto Abraham, As for Sarai thy wife, thou shalt not call her Sarai. Thou shalt not call her Sarai. Now, my friends, in life, perhaps the one thing we treasure most of all our possessions is our name.
Ian, how long do we have to go on being children?
I'm almost not a child at all. But you'll have to be a child for years and years and years.
But not all my life.
Probably not all your life, but a lot of your life. At least until you're 10.
Oh, dear.
And so, I felt like a prisoner doomed to serve something near a life sentence. I welcomed neither the coming of the days nor their departure. And then, suddenly, into my life, into all our lives, came Auntie Jane. This is how it came about. One summer's evening, while my father was in the garden trimming the hedges, my mother felt her chest was well enough to allow her to risk going to church on her own. When she returned, she was unusually animated.
Was it a good service?
Oh, Ray. During the hymn singing, there was a woman with the most beautiful voice in the pew behind me. I've never heard such a voice in the congregation before.
Well, she should be asked to join the choir.
She could take solos on her own, Ray. Anyway, when the service was over, I went up to her and introduced myself. She was absolutely charming, charming. And do you know? Well, it didn't come as a surprise to me. She's been a professional singer and sung in the Queen's Hall with Hedel Nash.
Well, she sounds to me a bit too good for our church.
Oh, you'll find her delightful, really. I've invited her to come home for supper after church next week.
Oh.
Her name is Jane Bauer, Mrs. Jane Bauer.
Uh-huh. Where's Mr. Bauer?
Oh, I don't know. I didn't ask.
I didn't like the prospect of that visit one little bit. There was nothing I knew to be more embarrassing than singing, except perhaps going to the lavatory. And the terrible thought crossed my mind that she might decide that everyone in the family had to sing.
May I introduce to one and all a great singer from the Queen's Hall?
Good evening to you all. I am a singer from the Queen's Hall. Now we are all about to sing, and you will begin.
No, please, I can't, I really can't.
I need not have worried.
Do come in, Jane. These are the boys, Hugh and Ian.
Hello.
Hello.
And this is my husband, Raymond.
Hello.
Oh, good evening. Well, do come in.
Not only did she show no inclination to burst into song, at first she was rather reserved. And unlike most visitors, she seemed to have enough understanding of children not to make us the centre of attention. However, at one point in the evening, in a quickly whispered aside, she called Ian and me and gave us each a small package.
Mine's a car. Look, Daddy.
Oh, Jane, really, you shouldn't.
Of course I should.
Golly, a rubber crocodile. Just what I wanted. Thank you.
Oh, they're spoiled boys.
The following Sunday evening, Auntie Jane, for that's what we were soon encouraged and indeed wanted to call her, came again for supper. And that Sunday evening, there was a little revolution in our young lives.
Well, now, children, if you've both finished your suppers, you can both get down and read books for half an hour before bedtime.
What books do you both read?
Boring books about Jesus.
Phew.
God will kill you for saying that.
Now, Ian...
God usually kills people by fire or flood. Or he might decide to drive you mad by using his still, small voice.
God would do no such thing, Ian. Have either of you boys heard of the game Rummy?
No.
Oh, Rummy's great fun.
How do you play it, Auntie?
Well, first of all, you need two packs of cards.
Jane, actually, we don't allow card games on Sundays.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Claire. I didn't realise.
Oh, we want to play rummy. We want to play rummy.
Yes,
children, please.
Teaching us how to play rummy is not the same as playing rummy.
Oh, we'll do it another evening.
We want to play rummy now.
Yes, we do.
Please.
Yes.
Oh, no, Jane, you weren't to know.
You know, of course, Claire, that the real evil of card playing comes with the passing of money.
Yes, but Sunday is the seventh day of the week, the day God rested.
I feel so embarrassed.
I don't think it'd be too harmful if they just played one game before they went to bed, since there is no passing of money.
Oh, well, if you think so, Ray.
Goody, goody!
Thank you for letting us play Mummy Rummy.
Yeah, Mummy Rummy.
Just one game. And you boys make doubly sure you both say your prayers before you get into your beds tonight.
Auntie Jane's visits became more and more frequent. And somehow, gradually, the stiffness of our home gave way to a gentle warmth. We had become a happy family. One night, I remember in particular, Mummy asked Auntie Jane to tuck us in after we'd gone to bed.
Do you know, I have a special name for you.
Have you?
Yes. From now on, I'm going to call you Plum. My little Plum.
And am I going to be your little Plum?
I think you are, yes.
Like all children, sometimes Ian and I would creep down from our bedroom at night and sit secretly outside the living room, hoping to hear grown-up secrets. One evening, while Ian and I were listening outside the living room door, I heard a conversation I could hardly believe.
And I suppose it does worry me, but then, of course, one really can't completely protect children from the world.
I'm sure that's so.
I remember when I was about 16, as I was crossing the New North Road after a church meeting, I passed some navvies repairing the road. And one of them said a word that so upset me, I couldn't sleep all that night.
How upsetting.
I couldn't even bring myself to tell my parents.
What word was it?
Oh, Ray, don't ask me.
Oh, come along, out with it. After all, you're not 16 any longer.
It will shock Jane.
Don't say it if you don't want to, Claire, but I'm sure it won't shock me.
Well, the word was bloody.
Bloody?
You don't have to repeat it, Ray.
I'm afraid there are lots of far worse words than that. When I served in France, some of the men under me could use real corkers for swear words.
That doesn't make the word I heard any the better.
I'm afraid you don't know what the real world's like.
Perhaps that's a good thing, Ray. Whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are beautiful, whatsoever things are of good repute, think on these things.
Sometimes I think people use swear words without realising quite what they're saying.
I'm sure they do.
You know, Claire, your telling that story reminds me. Hedel Nash would occasionally come out with a blue one.
Well, most men do.
Ray,
I don't know whether I should tell you this story.
Oh, well, let's hear it, Jane.
Well, as you know, Hedel Nash usually sings the tenor part in Handel's Messiah each year at the Albert Hall.
And so beautifully.
Well, one year he phoned up his agent and asked how the bookings were coming along. And the agent said, "I'm sorry, Mr. Nash, but so far there are no bookings for the Messiah as yet." "What?" replied Hedel. "And me the best bloody Messiah in the business?"
Oh, dear Jane. How can a man with such a beautiful voice say such an awful word?
Oh, dear. I hope I haven't shocked you again, Claire.
Well, it is a very funny story. I can see that. But in the Messiah, he sings the words of the Almighty.
Oh, I should think that at the way the world's going, even the Almighty must be tempted to say a few corkers once in a while.
The following day, encouraged by this overheard conversation, an incident occurred that was to prove the process of liberalisation in my home had distinct limits.
Hugh, will you please tidy up all the toys on your bedroom floor?
Oh, bloody.
What did you say?
Oh, bloody.
Go straight to your room and don't you dare come down until I tell you. You're a lucky boy I don't make you wash your mouth out with soap and water.
Sometimes when our parents went out together, Auntie Jane would babysit. We loved these times. I don't know whether she knew any fairy stories. Certainly I can never recall her telling any. We were privileged to far finer fare.
Are you married, Auntie Jane?
Of course she's not. If she were, she'd have a husband, wouldn't she?
Yeah.
I was married once.
Was he a singer too?
He had a lovely voice, Plum, but he wasn't a singer. We met in a very strange way. Well, it wasn't all that strange for those days, I suppose, during the war.
Was he a soldier?
Don't keep asking questions, Hugh.
He was a soldier, and a very handsome one. And we first met in an air raid shelter during one of the Zeppelin raids.
Did you love him the moment you saw him?
I think I did, yes. And I think it was the same for him. Oh, it was so wonderful. You see, both my parents died when I was a little girl, and I'd been brought up by my two elder sisters. Well, they were kind to me, but it wasn't like having a proper mummy and daddy.
No.
So when I met Ralph, I suddenly felt I'd moved into a warm, beautiful world. We had such a wonderful time together during his leave. And we did lots of things probably most people would think were rather boring, but aren't at all boring when you're in love.
What sorts of things?
Well, we walked along the embankment at nights, holding hands, and we went to the National Gallery to look at the pictures.
Still holding hands?
Still holding hands. And we had endless cups of tea in little cafes, and do you know, not only our hands touched then, under the table, our feet would touch as well.
Golly, you must have really been in love.
When the leave came to an end and he went off back to France, I went to see him off at Waterloo Station. And as the train pulled away, he suddenly shouted out, "When I come back, will you marry me?" And I called back, "Yes, yes, I will, Ralph." And he blew me a kiss, and I blew him a kiss, and we waved at each other until the train went out of sight.
And did he come back and marry you?
Auntie said she married him.
Yes, he came back, Plum. And we were married and took a small flat in Streatham, and we were so happy. You see, he was a man full of fun and happiness, and, oh, we made such plans. When the war was over, he wanted to move to the country, and we would start a chicken farm.
I've always wanted a chicken.
Shut up, Hugh.
And we were going to have lots and lots of children.
How many, about?
Oh, at least four.
That would cost a lot of money when it came to buying them Christmas presents.
Oh, we wouldn't have minded. Not a bit.
What happened then, Auntie, after you were married?
Well, he went back to France again, and after he'd gone, what do you think I discovered?
That he'd left his gun behind.
Don't be batty.
No, he took his gun, but I found I was going to have a baby.
Oh,
I was so happy, so very happy. But then the news came through. He had, in hospital, he had died.
Had the Germans killed him?
No, that's not why he died. At first, nobody quite knew why he died. It was so sudden.
Did he die for the love of you?
I nearly died for my love of him. And I lost the baby.
Oh.
What made him die?
It took a long time for the doctors to find out. Apparently, he'd swallowed a bristle from his toothbrush, and it did something to him, and he died. Anyway, that's enough of sad things. Now then, what game shall we play before you both go up to bed?
Rummy! Ian?
Yes?
I'm never, ever going to clean my teeth again. Never. Never.
No.
That Christmas, the full glory of Auntie Jane's presence discreetly displayed itself. Earlier Christmases had not been much better than Sundays.
As I sit in my own home, I'm thinking of the great multitude who are listening to my voice, whether they be in British homes.
But with Auntie Jane, Christmas became children's time. The whole house became a hustle and bustle of joyful activity. That Christmas Eve, the neighbours were invited in for a quick glass of ginger wine. Of course, they acted true to form, but it didn't matter.
My wife, Doris, my wife would love to come this very evening, but alas and alack, at present, she's tied up with the turkey.
As we was getting ready to come here, Yvonne said it must be well over 10 years since we've been invited into the Ilsleys. And, do you know, I worked it out, and she was absolutely right.
I can remember every house I've been invited into in Kemble Road, and when, and why, and for how long.
Yvonne is so sociable.
Well, I'm sure she is, Mr. Herbert. Now, come into the living room, and we'll all celebrate the season's goodwill.
How's your chest, Claire?
Oh, not too bad, Raymond. Before we end, I do hope Jane will sing something for us.
Oh, dear, I really don't think my voice is up to it this evening, Claire.
Well, I'm sure my wife would be only too happy to oblige, if Mrs. Bower doesn't feel up to it. Yvonne sings What Shall We Do with the Drunken Sailor as though she'd spent all her life with drunken sailors. You wouldn't believe it unless you heard it.
I'm sure, yes. Perhaps later, Mr. Herbert. Come along now, Jane.
Oh, well, very well, but don't say you haven't been warned.
I know where I'm going, and I know who's going with me. I know who I love, but the dear knows who I'll marry. I have stockings of silk, shoes of fine green leather.
In the late January of that year, my mother's asthma, that had been so much better, suddenly became worse.
Is Mummy going to die, Daddy?
Of course she's not stupid.
She's going to get better. Properly. But in order to get properly better, she's going to have to spend a little time in the Brompton Hospital.
Oh, poor Mummy.
Yeah. I hope she won't be there for long. But while she's gone, Auntie Jane is coming to look after us all.
Is she?
Goody gums!
It was then that we got to know certain secret things about Auntie Jane.
Hugh, go and have a look in the airing cupboard. You'll see something very interesting.
What, a toy or something?
Monkey brain. It's something grown up. Very grown up, as a matter of fact.
Oh.
It's knickers. Auntie Jane's knickers.
Golly.
They're blue and they're silky.
Oh.
Be careful how you touch them. She mustn't find out.
No. Would she mind if we saw them?
Of course she would. Everyone knows ladies' knickers are the biggest secret in the whole world. So big a secret, even Jesus didn't know about them.
I'll be very careful.
As I touched Auntie Jane's blue silk knickers, I felt a strange, half-focused delight that was highlighted and made awesome by a sense that, briefly, I was entering into the secret and magical world of the adult. The following summer, Auntie Jane came away on holiday with us to Ferring-on-Sea. All day long, Ian and I would play in the sand and jump in and out of the sea, splashing water all around and yelling out with the delight of it all.
Come in when you start to feel the cold, won't you, boys?
And periodically, shivering, we'd pick our way up the pebble beach, and as Mother or Auntie Jane dried us in large, heavy towels, we'd munch away at sandwiches, sandwiches that, however carefully packed, always somehow seemed to be garnished with a little sand. And staring to the open sea, we'd be totally and thoughtlessly happy.
Hugh, are you asleep?
No.
I saw something today.
What?
If I tell you, you must never tell anyone, and you mustn't even think about it. Promise?
Promise. What is it?
I don't think I'll tell you.
You must. You said you would, and I won't tell anyone about it, and I won't think about it. And what's more, I'll give you 6 marbles.
What colour?
Bloods.
All right. Come over to my bed, and I'll whisper it. I've seen Auntie Jane with no clothes on.
Golly, what did you see?
Well, she's got 2 large breasts. Do they know what breasts are in the infant school?
Of course we do. They're like balloons and they feed babies.
That's right. And I also saw her wee-wee.
What was that like?
Well, it was like nothing.
Nothing?
Nothing. Covered with hair. You see, ladies don't really have wee-wees. At least, Auntie Jane hasn't got one.
Oh.
Now shut up and go back to your bed. And don't forget about the 6 bloods tomorrow.
On the last Wednesday of the last week of our holiday at Ferring-on-Sea, it rained.
They can't go to the sea, Ray. They'll catch their death.
I've already told them.
But after all, Mummy, the sea is only rain that stays down rather than falls down.
You loony bin.
It's no good arguing.
After lunch, why don't we all go into Worthing and see what's on at the cinema?
Yes.
It'll be my little holiday treat.
Oh, no, Jane.
Certainly not. You've paid out more than you should already.
Can we please go, though, Daddy? Oh,
I don't know, Hugh.
Daddy!
Be quiet, Hugh.
Look who's in the seats in front of us.
Be quiet, Hugh.
It's Mr. and Mrs. Herbert.
All right, but be quiet. They want to see the film as much as we do.
Now, come along. Come along, everybody. Let's try and beat everyone to getting out of the car park.
Daddy, yes? Mr. Herbert's calling out to you.
Hurry, hurry,
Mr.
everybody.
Elsley.
Come on.
Hey, you must talk to Mr. and Mrs. Herbert.
Yes, yes. Hello, Mr. Herbert. Mrs. Herbert.
Mrs. Herbert was the first one to spot you.
I said to myself, then I said to my husband, what a small world it is. Yes.
It is a small world, my love, as you say. I mean, when have we all met like this in an Epsom cinema?
Never.
As my wife so rightly says, never.
Did you enjoy the film?
Well, yes, if you can persuade yourself that there actually was somebody called Robin Hood.
There was somebody called Robin Hood.
No, I'm afraid not, young Hugh. You can't win all the arguments in life, you know.
Daddy, there was somebody called Robin Hood, wasn't there?
Yes, be quiet for a moment, Hugh. We've got to try and get to the car park before everybody wants to get out their car.
Down here for the day, then, are you, Mrs. Ilsley?
We're staying at Herring-on-Sea, Mr. Herbert.
Good Lord. Did you hear that, Yvonne? More proof of your view about it being a small world. Look, when are you going back? It would be nice to all meet up again, don't you think?
I'm afraid, Mr. Herbert, we're rather heavily booked for the last remaining days. Come along, children. We mustn't lose your father.
Hugh, come and help me.
What are you doing?
I'm building a sandcastle.
Oh, all right. Let's make it so big even the sea can't knock it down.
The sea can knock everything down if it wants to.
It couldn't knock down the real castle.
Yes, it could, if you gave it enough waves.
Ian?
Yes?
Do you think Auntie Jane would ever marry again?
How should I know?
If Auntie Jane did marry again, would she have to marry someone the same age?
The same age as who, stupid?
As her.
I don't know. Why? Do you want to marry her, then?
No.
Yes, you do. You're blushing.
No, I don't. I don't. I don't.
In the car on the way home at the end of the holiday, Auntie Jane was in the back between Ian and me, and she had one arm round each of us. And I remember that although we chatted away at the beginning of the journey, by the time we'd reached the South Downs, we all went quiet. And it was then that Auntie Jane began to sing.
Southerly, blow the wind south o'er the bonny blue sea.
It brought tears to my eyes, making me sit back well in my seat for fear of my brother seeing.
Southerly, blow bonny breeze, my lover to me.
That night, Auntie Jane came and tucked us both in before she left.
Thank you, Auntie.
Why do you thank me?
For a happy holiday.
You made the holiday happy because you know who you are, don't you?
Yes.
You're my little plum.
Will I always be your little plum?
Always and forever. Now, I'll give you a kiss and then you must go straight to sleep.
And Auntie Jane gave me a kiss. And that was the last I ever saw of her. I never, ever saw her again. At first, when she didn't come to the house, I thought she must be ill or something had happened to her.
Mummy, where's Auntie Jane?
I don't know, dear.
Why doesn't she come round here anymore?
Auntie Jane probably has lots of other things to do apart from just coming here.
She's not died or anything, has she, Mummy?
Of course not, Hugh.
For his part, my father returned to his garden with renewed commitment.
Daddy?
Yes, what is it?
Where is Auntie Jane?
Are you wearing your best shoes in the garden?
might get them dirty.
Go in and change them straight away. You know you're not allowed to wear them out here. How many more times do I have to tell you?
I think I know where Auntie Jane has gone.
Where?
She's gone to Jesus.
Where is Jesus?
In heaven, of course. Everyone knows that.
Heaven is in the sky, isn't it?
I suppose everyone in the infant school thinks heaven is in the sky. But Mrs. Winters, our teacher, told us last week where it really is.
Where is it?
It's inside you.
Inside me?
Yes. The kingdom of heaven is inside you.
But why should it have to be inside me and not inside anybody else?
I don't know. Mrs. Winter's spectacles broke after she told us that.
The days passed, the weeks passed, the months passed, the years passed. Ian and I grew up and left home. Our parents grew old and retired to a cottage near the city of Exeter, where my father had once lived as a young boy. I would occasionally visit them, not as often as Ian, not as often as I should. But somehow I could never bring myself to do that, and never once did I raise the mystery of Auntie Jane's disappearance, because never once did they ever mention her name. My mother died of a stroke on the 15th of April, 1968. My father survived her by 5 years. And that really is the end of the story. And I have to confess, the memory of Auntie Jane and the mystery of her sudden disappearance almost vanished from my conscious memory. But then one day I was passing through Epsom Town, and having a little time to spare, decided to visit Kemble Road and take a look at my old home. I considered for a moment knocking on the front door and having a word with the occupants. I'd have liked to have had a look round, but I hadn't the courage. So, though I suspected it would be rather pointless, I knocked on the door of 175, where our old neighbours, Mr. and Mrs. Walters, had lived.
What's to do? What's to do?
You are Mr. Walters.
I am, so.
Do you know who I am?
I don't...
Hugh Ilsley, Raymond's son.
Yes. He's gone over, has he, your father?
Yes.
And your mother too, I expect.
I'm afraid so.
So many of them have, yes. My wife, Doris, gone over. Mr. Herbert at 171, he'd gone over. His wife, Yvonne Herbert, gone over. All gone over.
Sad.
Oh, yes, it is. It is sad, yes. in the garden, though, can you see the gnomes are still keeping well enough, are they not? Eh? That's the secret of it in life. Be a gnome. Be a gnome!
Yes, I'm sure.
Well, now, what has become of your brother?
Ian.
Yes.
Oh, he's done very well. He's a city stockbroker.
Really? Yes. Well, you must have a cup of cocoa.
No, that's very kind of you, but I've just had a cup of coffee just before I came.
Ah, well, when you get old, they'll give you cocoa. That's the way you know. You're old. People always giving you cocoa. I'm old, you see, so I have to drink a cocoa. It is a pity my wife is not here. She'd have loved to have seen you. I got up one morning and made breakfast and went to call her. But she died in bed. She died. So all the breakfast I'd made was wasted. She loved you boys, you know.
She was a very charming lady.
Yes. Oh, yes, she was. Mind you, she could speak her mind, yes. She spoke her mind with the Herberts, you know, yes, when she found out what Mrs. Herbert had told your mother.
What did Mrs. Herbert tell my mother?
Well, you know, don't you?
No.
About your father and that lady who was always in your home. What was her name now?
Jane Bower.
Jane, yes. You and your family and the Jane lady went on holiday with the Herberts one year, didn't you, to the seaside?
No, we once met the Herberts at the seaside.
Yes, perhaps so. Well, one evening on that holiday, Mr. Herbert saw your father and that lady, what is she called, walking along the seafront, and they were arm in arm, and Mr. Herbert followed them. For quite a way. And suddenly they stopped, your father and Jane, and they stopped and they kissed. And they kissed each other. Yes.
Did they?
Oh, yes. They kissed each other. Well, That's what Mr. Herbert told everybody in Kemble Road, and that's what Yvonne Herbert told your mother, and that's what made Doris so angry.
Well, yeah. Well.
Yes. Your father was always a very circumspect man, wasn't he? He's very well-dressed and circumspect. Still, even well-dressed, circumspect men have their moments.
She brought such joy into our lives.
You're not surprised, then, that he kissed her?
I'm surprised he dared express a feeling we all in different ways had for her.
I never really knew her, of course, but... Mrs. Herbert should never have told your mother. Tell the neighbours if you like, but not your mother.
Mrs. Herbert couldn't have known the cruelty of what she did, the unhappiness it brought.
Don't you be so sure of that, young Hugh. No. No.
That night I had a strange dream. I was a young boy again, and I was wandering alone through a rapidly darkening countryside. At times I wondered if I'd lost my way, and fear mounted inside me. Then, from some distant woods, I heard a voice singing, singing a song I'd only heard once before.
Blow the wind south o'er the bonny blue sea.
Auntie Jane! Auntie Jane! I loved you so much, Auntie Jane.
Oh, bonny breeze, my lover to me.
In Auntie Jane by Geoffrey Parkinson, William Edel played Hugh, Luke Robertson, the younger Hugh, Andrew Sachs, father, June Barry, mother, and Elizabeth Mansfield, Jane. Mr. Walters was Bill Wallace, Mr. Herbert, Christian Rodsker, Mrs. Herbert, Jenny Howe, Ian, Michael Ford, and Jesus and the Methodist minister were David Bannerman. Auntie Jane was directed in Bristol by Sean McLaughlin.